Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
I am Marlene Peterson, and we are here to learn about learning by heart. And I see something really extraordinary on the horizon. I see some things lining up that I think are going to be pretty amazing, and mothers are the key players in this. And in order for you to be able to catch the vision of what I'm seeing, I need to do a little bit of layering. So I'd like to start with a story, and if you've heard me before, you maybe have heard this story before. But it's the story of the Snow Queen by Hans Christian Andersen. Long, long ago, there lived a hobgoblin, a demon, really, who one day made a mirror that had a particular power. Everything that was good or beautiful that was reflected in it was made to look small and ugly, while everything that was bad and ugly was magnified, and every fault could be plainly seen. The scholars in his demon school carried the mirror all over the world until there wasn't a land or a people who had not been looked at in this distorted mirror. They thought it would look even funnier if they would carry it high up into the heaven to look at the angels in it. But the higher they rose, the slipperier the mirror became, until it slipped through their fingers and crashed to the earth, shattering into millions of pieces. Now the mirror caused even more unhappiness. For if a speck no larger than a grain of sand lodged in a person's eye, it had the property of the whole mirror, and they viewed everything the wrong way. They could neither see rightly nor justly, and even worse, if a tiny shard entered the heart grew as cold as ice. The pieces soon covered the whole earth. The demon laughed so hard he nearly split his sides at the mischief that he had caused. Now, in a large town, there lived two poor little children who loved each other dearly. Kai and Gerda often played under the red rose bush that grew near their homes. One day, just as the clock struck 12, Kai said, "Oh, something has struck my heart, and it feels like there's something in my eye." When Gerda asked what was wrong and started to cry, Kai mockingly told her to stop crying because she looked ugly when she cried, and besides, there was nothing wrong with him. "But look," he cried, "look at the worm on that rose, and why is that rose crooked? And what an ugly little box it's growing in." He kicked the box and ripped off the roses as he ran off to play with the boys. By and by, he began to make fun of the townspeople, and the people laughed and thought he was very clever. He now thought that the stories in the books his grandmother told were very stupid. One day, as he was playing on his sleigh, a large white sleigh carrying a white figure wrapped in white fur circled the field. Kai was intrigued, grabbed hold of the back of the sleigh, and off they flew. Faster and faster they went. He tried to let go, but he couldn't. He was afraid, and he tried to pray, but all he could remember were his multiplication tables. At long last, the sleigh stopped and the driver stood up. She was tall and beautiful, a snow queen. She opened her warm fur coat for Kai to snuggle in. "Are you still cold?" she asked as she kissed his forehead. Although his heart was now as almost a lump of ice, he somehow no longer felt cold or afraid. He thought the face of the Snow Queen was the most beautiful he had ever seen. He could imagine nothing more perfect. He proudly told her he could do arithmetic as far as fractions in his head, and that he knew the number of square miles and number of inhabitants in the country, and the Snow Queen smiled. Off they flew again, over woods and lakes, over sea and land, and Kai felt perfectly safe. Meanwhile, little Gerda didn't believe what the townspeople said, that Kai must have drowned in the river. She set off to search for him, and after a hard and difficult journey, arrived at the magnificent ice palace of the Snow Queen. There were hundreds of empty, vast, and cold rooms in the palace, all made of drifted snow. The largest hall stretched for several miles. In the midst of this empty, endless hall of snow was a frozen lake. and there, in the center of it, stood the Snow Queen. She called the lake the Mirror of Reason and said it was the best and indeed the only one in the world. When Gerda finally found little Kai, he was quite blue with cold, almost black. But he didn't feel it, for the Snow Queen had kissed away his icy shiverings. There he was, dragging sharp, flat pieces of ice to and fro, trying to get them to fit together in different ways. It was the icy game of reason he was playing, and in his eyes the figures he created were very remarkable and of the highest importance. Yet, try though he may, he could not create the one figure he desperately wanted to make. He was trying to form the word eternity, for the Snow Queen had told him, "When you find out this, you shall be your own master, and I will give you the whole world and a new pair of skates." Gerda ran to Kai and threw her arms around his neck. "Kai, dear little Kai, I found you at last." But he sat quite still, stiff and cold. Then Gerda wept hot tears that penetrated his heart and began to melt the lump of ice until Kai also burst into tears, washing away the speck that had lodged in his eye. "Gerda, where have you been and where am I?" As he looked all around him, he exclaimed, "How cold it is, and how large and empty it all looks." The two danced, crying tears of joy, until they fell to the ground wrapped in each other's arms. And as they lied there, their figure formed at last the word eternity, and Kai was forever free from the Snow Queen's power. The two made their way back to their red rose bush where they both sat, grown up, yet children at heart, and it was summer. Warm, beautiful summer. Now we're going to come back and visit the Snow Queen in a minute. But I now want to kind of layer in an impression of contrast. I was flying home from a conference several weeks ago, and I had a window seat. And as I sat and looked at the ground beneath me, I was noticing how tiny all the cities were. And for whatever reason, I try to picture the Tower of Babel down there. I think it's because the tower is such a large building. And I pictured the people that had built the tower standing at the base of it and looking up and going, "Wow, wow, look what we have built by the workmanship of our own hands. It's magnificent. And we can see from down here, it's so tall, it must reach clear up to heaven. We can just walk our way up." And maybe they thought, "Bring on the floods again. We've got it covered this time. If the waters come, we're just going to run up to the top of the tower and save ourselves." And then I tried to picture the tower from God's perspective. And I was just a couple of miles up in the air, but I looked down and I thought, that really was probably just a little dot down there. And then, I don't know why, but my mind took me to Trump Tower. And I tried to picture Trump Tower down there. And I converted all of his wealth to gold bricks. And I piled all the gold bricks around Trump Tower. And from where I was, just a couple miles up looking down, it was nothing. It was a little dot. And then I looked around and I tried to put it in perspective to how big is our country? How maybe I was taking in 50 or 100 square miles. How big is 2,000 miles, how big is 25,000 miles around? And I just got this perspective, this huge planet that we're on, and that little Trump Tower just got tinier. And then if you've ever seen it, if you've seen it where it takes the Earth and then it puts the Earth next to the Sun, and the Sun becomes the dot. And then you put the solar system next to the Milky Way and our solar system becomes a dot. And then you put the Milky Way next to the universe, and the Milky Way becomes a dot. And that little Trump Tower is nothing of a nothing of a nothing, completely insignificant. Now here came the impression of the contrast. I sat and I looked around, and as far as my eyes could see, I saw light. Light everywhere. And I thought of how we're taught that the light of Christ fills the immensity of space. We have a lot of different words for that light. We call it truth. We call it living waters, that when you drink of these waters, you never thirst again. We call it the Spirit of the Lord. the light of the Christ, of Christ. And the effect of this light upon us is that the fruit of the Spirit is that we feel joy. We feel love and peace. We gain understanding. These are the gifts of the Spirit. Well, when people come to understand this great gift of joy and love and peace, this is the pearl of great price, that the merchant, when he learned of it, said he would sell everything he had to own this pearl. This was the joy, the remembering of King Lamoni in the Book of Mormon. He said he would give all that he owned, even his own kingdom, to have this joy. It's the fruit on the tree that Lehi saw in vision, the fruit of the tree. It was love. It was El Dorado. This was interesting, maybe just to me. I found a 1904 children's book, and the woman that had compiled the stories about El Dorado, you know, the great gold city, had done a lot of research, and the Native Americans all shared this legendary hero, who, of course, we know who that was, who had taught them about a golden kingdom and had said he would return again. So when the Padres came and started teaching them about Christ, they said, El Dorado, golden. But they weren't talking about the gold. They were talking about the golden kingdom that they had learned. This is the Holy Grail. This is eternity that Kai was trying to form, that can't be found by the Isaac game of reason. In Earth's economy, the richest person is the one with the most money. But in Heaven's economy, the richest person is the one with the greatest capacity for light, and thereby the most joy. Remember, we're taught, man is that he might have joy. If God's greatest desire for us is to have joy, then shouldn't that be the object of education with our children? To find the ways whereby they have the greatest capacity for light, and therefore the greatest capacity for joy. So the question becomes, how do we increase this capacity for light? Well, when I think of secret combinations, I think of sinister persons in dark rooms combining forces together to overthrow the world, to do works of darkness and evil and destruction. And I thought, if there's a secret combination, there must be a sacred combination, right? Webster defines sacred as that which proceeds from God. So what is this sacred combination that produces light? And I've come to believe that there is a sacred combination that is so simple that you may brush it off. But here is what I think it is. Heart and mind. Or another way of putting it, the more our heart desires that which is good and beautiful and true, and the more the mind is willing to comply and obey true commandments and true principles, the greater the increase of light. And I'm going to try and show this to you. If you take away one of the combination parts, the light is blocked. You have to have both pieces in place. We are a very mind-focused, academic-based culture. You know you're in the realm of the mind because you can test and measure it. How far away is the sun? What's the population of New York? What is the definition of this word? Isn't that what we focus on in school mostly, is the mind? The mind feeds on facts and information. We associate reason and science with the mind. And science really is all about discovering the laws and the principles by which everything operates, right? The mind is always looking for proof and evidence. Science and the mind are good. But Aristotle understood over 2,000 years ago that educating the mind without educating the heart is no education at all. It's only half the combination. The heart, on the other hand, is completely immeasurable. How wide is joy? How deep is love? You can't measure it. But the heart is all about our desire. What do we desire? What are our visions and our dreams? And actually, the deeper something travels into our heart, we completely use the capacity, the ability to describe it. Like the poet said, the deeps of the soul, like the deeps of the ocean, are silent. When you feel something deeply, you lose the words. Think of the Nephites. As Christ taught them, the deeper the message sunk into their hearts, they lost the ability to express what they were feeling. The tools that we have, the tools that we've been given for stirring these feelings and for awakening desires are the arts, music, imagery, poetry, and story. You even find the word art in the word heart. And these are the tools that you have been given to stir the feelings and awaken desires in the hearts of your children. You can't do it with facts. You cannot do it with information. You have to use one of these tools to open their hearts. There is a law in nature that which we don't use atrophies from disuse. So I was reading about Charles Darwin, and in his later life, he wrote, "If I had to live my life again, I would have made it a rule to read some poetry and listen to some music at least once a week, for perhaps the parts of my brain now atrophied would thus have been kept alive through use. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness. Formerly, I was led to a firm conviction of God and the immortality of the soul." He recalled writing in his journal when he was a young man, he'd gone to a Brazilian forest and just being taken in by the grandeur of this beautiful place that he was in. And he wrote in his journal at that time, "It is not possible to give an adequate idea of the higher feelings of wonder, admiration, and devotion which fill and elevate the mind." But then he continued later, "I well remember my conviction that there is more in man than the mere breath of his body. But now the grandest scene would not cause any such conviction and feelings to rise in my mind. Disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress." On the other hand, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And I would add, they shall see God in the trees and in the flowers and in the stars. They shall see God in history. They'll see God in the inspired arts and music, and they'll see God in their lights, in their own lives. God cannot be found by the icy game of reason. He can only be felt. And by neglecting the heart, and as we do this academic push with our children, we are hardening their hearts. We're seeing a huge drop. Who was I talking earlier? That the number of children in our church that are growing up and will stay true to the faith is plummeting. And I would say a lot of it can come back, that their hearts are being hardened. That combination is not in place and the light is being blocked. It's a serious problem. Hard-heartedness blocks the light. I've come to believe that there is an order to this combination. The heart develops before the brain when the baby's forming in the womb, and emotions develop before the intellect outside of the womb. In fact, neuroscientists who watch the brain see that there's a first intellectual shift at about age, any guess? 8. And why is that? The Lord says we don't baptize till 8 because he said prior to 8, they do not have the capacity to reason between right and wrong. That means nature has reserved these first 8 years especially, but in large measure the first 12 to 14 years, for hearts to be open and impressionable. And that's the time that if you immerse your children in story, picture, rhyme, and music, you're going to be able to make impressions of the good and the true and the beautiful on their hearts. That's the time given. You bypass those years and focus on the academics, you're going to lose an opportunity that is really hard to get later. Not impossible, but it gets harder. Think about it if you teach a child the mechanics of reading first and the decoding of words. What good is that to a child if he has no desire to read? But if you tend to the heart first so that they love stories and they want to get at the reading, they will find a way to master the mechanics. It's an order thing. Tend to the heart first and then the mind. Both are in place. So let me do just a little bit of demonstration when I'm talking about using art and teaching subjects. Let's apply a little artistry to the Civil War. You know, often the Civil War is taught with statistics and the key players and the battles and things. Let's add a little poetry and story. So this first one, this is actually an illustration by N.C. Wyeth that goes with a poem called The Picket Guard. "All quiet along the Potomac, they say, except now and then a stray picket is shot as he walks on his beat to and fro by a rifleman hid in the thicket. 'Tis nothing. A private or two now and then will not count in the news of the battle. Not an officer lost, only one of the men moaning out, all alone, the death rattle. All quiet along the Potomac tonight, where the soldiers lie peacefully dreaming, their tents in the rays of the clear autumn moon or the light of the watchfires are gleaming. A tremulous sigh as the gentle night wind through the forest leaves softly is creeping, while stars up above with their glittering eyes keep guard, for the army is sleeping. There's only the sound of the lone sentry's tread as he tramps from the rock to the fountain and thinks of the two in the low trundle bed far away in the cot on the mountain. His musket falls slack, his face dark and grim grows gentle with memories tender as he mutters a prayer for the children asleep, for their mother. May heaven defend her. The moon seems to shine just as brightly as then that night when the love yet unspoken leaped up to his lips, when low murmured vows were pledged to be ever unbroken. Then, drawing his sleeve roughly over his eyes, he dashes off tears that are welling and gathers his gun closer up to its place as if to keep down the heart swelling. He passes the fountain, the blasted pine tree. The footstep is lagging and weary. Yet onward he goes through the broad belt of light towards the shades of the forest so dreary. Hark! Was it the night wind that rustled the leaves? Was it moonlight so wondrously flashing? It looked like a rifle. Ah, Mary, goodbye. And the lifeblood is ebbing and plashing. All quiet along the Potomac tonight. No sound save the rush of the river. While soft falls the dew on the face of the dead, the pickets off duty forever. You read something like that, it's not numbers and statistics, it's lives. And isn't that what you want your children to feel if you're studying something like the Civil War? Now let's bring to life the two generals. And keep in mind, these are enemies. These are the opposing generals. Let's do a little story about Robert E. Lee. And this took place just after the Battle of Gettysburg. I was badly wounded, says a private of the Army of the Potomac. A ball had shattered my left leg. I lay on the ground not far from the cemetery ridge. And as General Lee ordered his retreat, he and his officers rode near me. As he came along, I recognized him, and though faint from exposure and loss of blood, I raised up my hands, looked Lee in the face, and shouted as loud as I could, "Hurrah for the Union!" The general heard me, looked, stopped his horse, dismounted, and came toward me. I confess I at first thought he meant to kill me. But as he came up, he looked down at me with such a sad expression on his face that all fear left me, and I wondered what he was about. He extended his hand to me and, grasping mine firmly, looking right into my eyes, said, "My son, I hope you will be soon be well." If I live 1,000 years, I will never forget the expression on General Lee's face. Here he was defeated, retiring from a field that cost him and his cause almost their last hope, and yet he stopped to say words like those to a wounded soldier of the opposition who had taunted him as he passed by. As soon as the general had left me, I cried myself to sleep there on the bloody ground. Now let's turn to the other general, Ulysses S. Grant, and this is a little bit longer story. Ulysses S. Grant was 60 years old. He was healthy, wealthy, and wise. It seemed as though nothing could disturb or molest him. And yet, at one blow, the old general was struck down, wounded in the tenderest of all places, his honor, his reputation, his word. It was this way. In 1880, he had gone into business, investing $100,000 in the banking business in which one of his sons was a partner. But General Grant was not an active partner in this business. At first, the firm made lots of money. General Grant's name, of course, gave people confidence, and one of the partners was such a sharp and shrewd businessman that people called him the Napoleon of Finance. On the morning of Tuesday, the 6th of May, 1884, General Grant was, as he thought, a millionaire. Before sunset that same day, he knew he was ruined. The bank had failed. the Napoleon of finance, whom everyone thought so smart a businessman, had been too smart. He had speculated and lost everything. Worse than this, he had lied and stolen. He had used the name and fame of General Grant to back up wicked schemes and dishonorable transactions. He had used up all the money put into the business by General Grant and Mrs. Grant and the others who had gladly put in the money because of General Grant's name. And he had so turned and twisted and handled things that not a dollar was left in the business. General Grant and his sons were ruined. Their good names apparently were disgraced by being mixed up with the affairs and wickednesses of their bad and bold partner, who, as soon as he saw the truth was out, ran away like the thief and coward he was. Everyone was surprised. More than this, they were so startled that for a time, even the great name of Grant seemed beclouded, and thoughtless people, cruel people, the folks who liked to talk and to say things without thinking of consequences, said mean and hateful and wicked and untruthful things about this great and noble soldier who never in his life had done a dishonorable act or said a mean or unkind thing. It was hard, wasn't it? It was especially hard on a man such as General Grant. He never complained. He never spoke of the treatment to his friends, but it hurt terribly. It made him sick. And he developed a terrible trouble in his throat, cancer, that brought him months of suffering, of torture and agony. He set to work to do something to earn money. At first he was discouraged, for as he looked at the wreck of his fortune made by the dreadful business failure and knew that he was a sick man, no longer able to work or make his own living, a future looked very dark, and he could not see how he could make things better for his wife or the boys he so dearly loved. Then it was determined to write, as did Julius Caesar, the story of his life, the battles and campaigns. He saw a way out of his difficulties. He determined to try. Then the world saw one of the most remarkable things in all its long history, a sick man without experience or training, deliberately sitting down to write the story of his life, fighting off death with all the might and strength of his giant will in order to save his name from dishonor and leave something for his wife and children after the death that he knew was not far away. Writing or dictating sometimes 4, sometimes 6, sometimes 8 hours a day, so the months went on. It was a tremendous effort. In the 8 weeks that followed the 1st of May, he did more work in writing his book than in any other 8 weeks of his life. As an army in battle sometimes gathers up all its strength for a final charge or for a last stand against the foe, so the old general, weakened by disease, worried by anxiety, but determined to win, actually held death at bay until the work he had set himself to do was accomplished. At last, the work was done. The book was finished. On the first day of July, 1885, his preface was dated and signed. Just 3 weeks later, on the morning of the 23rd of July, 1885, the tired hand dropped limply within that of a patient, faithful wife. The last fight was over. The last victory had been won. The book he wrote and completed under those fearful conditions is one of the world's notable books. While its success more than met the desires of the writer and placed his family again in comfort and security, to the last, the great soldier's thoughts were all for peace. He had seen battles. He knew the horrors of war. He knew the beauty of peace. "Let us have peace," is what he used to say. Now imagine that. Two generals that were enemies, and yet they were both noble and honorable, weren't they? That's something my heart's going to have to work on. In fact, did you know that both the North and the South sang the song Battle Hymn of Freedom as their song? And think of the lessons that were taught to your heart in those two brief stories and the poem. I picked up forgiveness, compassion, reputation, courage, determination, honor. Facts cannot teach you any of those things. But do you now have an impression of both of these generals and even the fight that when you come back and you now read a textbook and their names are in there, won't it drop all these feelings that you just had? And of course, that's not the only thing about these men, But it plants a desire to want to learn more. And that's what I talk about when I talk about opening and warming hearts. So because we're a mind-based culture, you may be asking for the evidence of this pattern or this combination that I'm talking about, this heart and then mind and then spirit. So let me just touch on a couple of them. And actually, I've been going through the Book of Mormon again, looking for the pattern, and I find it over and over again. The very fact that we were first given a Book of Mormon, isn't that primarily a book of stories? And then we were given the Doctrine and Covenants, which is a book of doctrine, commandments, principles. And then we were given the temple, which is spirit-to-spirit communication. John the Baptist's role, wasn't it, to warm and open the hearts of the people, to prepare them so that Jesus could teach the law of the gospel in preparation for them to receive the gift of the Holy Ghost, who would teach them all things that they should do. Even the plan of salvation, the plan of happiness, the pre-existence, we were given a dream and a vision of possibilities. We're told we shouted for joy. I think not only out of joy, but for the prospect and the possibility of joy. And then what's our purpose here on earth except to fit ourselves to a law, to see if we will do all things that God will command us to do. And according to our desires and according to the law that we fit ourselves to, we will inherit a kingdom. And what's the difference between the kingdom? Light. Some kingdoms have greater capacity for light than others. The greater our desires, the more we keep the commandments, the greater our capacity for light. I even see the pattern in nature. You can plant a seed into the ground and shine light on it all day long, but until that ground warms up, the life force within that seed is going to remain dormant. And even in history, ancient Greece was noted for its love and desire for beauty. Ancient Rome was known for adherence to laws and justice. And then came Jesus, who taught of a spiritual kingdom. I think you'll find, as you keep your eyes open, you'll find the pattern in a lot of places. I know I do. As simple as this combination of heart and mind appears, the world has had a really hard time keeping it in balance. We either go one way or we go the other. So I want to take you just on a brief tour of a little bit of history, because what we're trying to do is balance heart and mind, faith and reason, art and science. And you find that in those rare moments that that balance happens, there's like a burst of light. And we even call these ages golden ages. So let's go back to 5th century BC, to the golden age of Greece. This was a time when Socrates was going around teaching the people how to think. You have Pericles, who's a wise ruler who is instituting wise rules, but he also is a lover of the arts, and he commissions great buildings to be built, like the Parthenon and the Acropolis, that are built by the highest standards of math and engineering, but they're crafted by artisans who love that which is beautiful. And these buildings still inspire us all these years later. You have the great Greek dramatists, Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, who were writing plays to keep the hearts of the Greeks warm. It's a wonderful golden age that we're still being influenced by 2,500 years later. Well, after a series of wars, they kind of felt their golden age slipping. And as we are prone to do, they started to think, well, man is pretty magnificent. We can reason our way out of this. So they thought, let's build some great academies. And if we can bring our young men into these academies and teach them how to think and how to reason and teach them how to persuade, then they can bring us back to our golden age. What they wanted to do was to produce great leaders by teaching them to reason. Not only did the Greeks, did these academies fail to produce a single leader of note, the Greeks slipped into slavery, never to rise again. Now go forward several hundred years to after the time of Christ, and now we have a time when we've swung the other way, and the people are ruled by their hearts and by their emotions. And the great power players of the time are the storytellers and the bards. They know they can sway the people to believe anything they want with their stories and their songs. And so you have these people that are driven by their fears and based on superstition and false tradition, and we call it the Dark Ages. There was no light, half of it. Now fast forward, a few hundred years to the beginning of the 14th century, and now you have the intellectual writings of the Greek arrive on the scene, and for that one brief moment, we have heart and mind, art and science, faith and reason bound together, and we have a rebirth, which is what Renaissance means. Renaissance means rebirth. And look at the giants that were produced in that time when it was combined. We have Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci. We have Shakespeare, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Columbus, and the great explorers who went out and explored new worlds, Martin Luther. Fantastic time. And then we move along, and man says, wow, man is magnificent, isn't he? And we moved into another age of reason. So it was in this age of reason in the 18th century that a very tender-hearted, kind man named Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi was born. And he looked around at the people, and he thought to himself, for all of the learning that's going on, it's not making your lives any better. You're miserable. And especially the children were miserable because the adults were so anxious for them to learn Greek so that they could get at the Greek writings that almost as soon as they could talk, they were hammering this Greek into them. And the kids were miserable. And Pestalozzi said there has to be another way. And he wrote, I wish to wrest education from cheap, artificial teaching tricks and entrust it to the eternal process of nature herself, to the light which God has kindled and kept alive in the hearts of fathers and mothers. Love is the sole and everlasting foundation in which to work. The primary law is this. The first instruction of the child should never be the business of the head or of the reason. It should always be the business of the heart. It is for a long time the business of the heart before it is the business of reason. So he was given charge of a group of a classroom of orphans, and he started to use story, rhyme, pictures, and song with these children with great success. And he didn't have much to work with. And even back in his day, they had school administrators who would stop by. And one day a school administrator came in and looked down, Mr. Pestalozzi, where are your test scores? Where are your reading scores? And he said, look around. The children, they're happy, they're engaged in learning, they're teaching each other. And he got the look of disapproval, because we only want the test scores. It's really hard to go up against the Snow Queen. Well, he came to understand the eternal laws of nature lead me back to your hand, Mother. He knew that the mother is the most effective teacher of the heart. Well, one of his followers was a man named Friedrich Froebel, who also understood it was the mothers who were the best teachers of the heart. The problem was the mothers were so overworked and exhausted just trying to keep their families alive. He knew that they couldn't bring him in to do one more thing. But he noticed it was the oldest girl in the family usually that had charge of the little ones. So he thought, what if we bring these older girls in with the siblings and we'll teach them, we'll train them, we'll prepare them so that when they become mothers, they'll be ready to assume this role as the educator of the heart. And he thought it might take three generations, but that was the plan. And so he opened the first kindergarten, meaning child garden, a place to grow children. The first kindergartens were organized to prepare mothers to assume their roles as the teachers of children's hearts. Well, now by the 19th century, the 1800s, Pestalozzi's writing started to influence other people, such as Charlotte Mason, who wrote, we allow no separation to grow up between the intellectual and spiritual life of children, but teach them that the divine spirit has constant access to their spirits and is their continual helper in all the interests, duties, and joys of life. He influenced Maria Montessori. Maria Montessori started a school among some of the poorest children in Rome. And on the opening day of the school, she stood up and she opened the day by quoting from Isaiah, arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. And then she added, perhaps it may be that this children's home may become a new Jerusalem, which, as it is multiplied, will bring light into education. She was criticized for that, and they asked her what she meant, and she said she scarcely knew, but I think we know. Pestalozzi's writings influenced Rudolf Steiner, who started the Waldorf method, if any of you are doing Waldorf. These are all heart methods, and they even influenced Carl Maeser, who brought the philosophy and planted it in the foundation of Brigham Young Academy in Provo. And then something wonderful happened. There was a group of these intellectual giants. Remember, this was a time of great learning. And these were scholars in history, literature, art, music, nature. And as they came to understand the importance of wrapping their knowledge in a story for children, they started to write these books, these wonderful books that were loaded with the wealth of their intellect, but wrapped in a story for a child to see and to feel. I love reading these books, and that's where I spend most of my time. In a lot of the prefaces, I see things like, "Dear boys and girls, I love you. I want you to be happy." And so they would load these stories with principles of happy living, and they would teach them, feed that desire for that which is good and beautiful, and desire for faith in God. It was a perfect blending of heart and mind, art and science, faith and reason. And this age of children's literature from 1880 to 1920 is called the Golden Age of Children's Literature. Well, then the mothers got on board. Something else wonderful happened, and they started to do what mothers do. They started to organize, and they started to form story groups. In the early 1900s, there was a revival in the art of storytelling, and they would meet together to try and figure out how they could become better storytellers. And then I just found this out. In 1910, the Delphian Society was formed, and what they wanted to do, they understood that mothers and women couldn't go away to college, so they brought college to them. And they created the Delphian Reading Course. And it was the equivalent of a bachelor's in classic studies, in history, literature, art, music, nature. And the women would get together once a month, and they would have study and conversations about what they were learning. Is it a coincidence that the generation that followed is known as the greatest generation? Well, then came the 20s and 30s, and the Snow Queen swooped onto the scene, and she was beautiful and irresistible, and a man named John Dewey was mesmerized, who was to go on and to change the course of education for decades to come. He signed a document in 1933 called the Humanist Manifesto, in which it states, "Reason and intelligence are the most effective instruments that humankind possesses. There is no substitute." Snow Queen all over again. And by the way, there is no God. Man is magnificent. Look at the workmanship of our own hands. And we have entered another age of reason, of facts and information, of scientific proof and evidence, of test and measure. And something else has happened that Hans Christian Andersen said would happen in the story of his Snow Queen. The world has turned upside down. That which was good is now seen as bad, and that which was bad is now seen as good, and every fault is magnified, and every good is mocked. I hope that you can begin to see why this call for more math and science, for more rigorous academics, for more academics introduced at younger and younger ages, is actually fueling the problem. I know I've said this before. You've looked up the word academic before. Merriam-Webster, having no practical importance, not involving or relating to anything real or practical, having no practical or useful significance. Because on its own, it's half the combination. And we don't just want academics, we want rigorous academics. Well, rigorous and rigor mortis have the same root word, rigor, which means stiffness and rigidness, even voluntary submission to pain. It's only half the combination. And we are trying again the failed solution of the Greeks. But here's what I can't stop thinking about. And this is the extraordinary event that I see lining up to happen. What if we can take this height of intellect that we have, I'm told that knowledge is doubling every 72 hours. What if we could hold on to this height of intellect and balance it out with a proportionate depth of heart? Wouldn't we expect to see a burst of light on the world again and the entrance into another golden age, unlike the world has ever seen before? I think that's exactly what's lining up. Because look at what has just happened in the last 10 to 15 years to make that possible. Look what technology has gifted us. Consider this, first of all. In the 10th century, a princess gave 200 sheep, a load of wheat, a load of rye, a load of millet, and several costly furs for one copy of a German monk's writing, while one of the Gospels written on parchment was so costly that only the fortune of a prince could purchase one. In 1999, Internet Archive was formed with the intention of digitizing every book that has ever been written and posting it online for you to read for free. So far, they've digitized over 11 million books, and they're doing it at the rate of 1,000 books a day. Phenomenal. And a part of that great harvest of books is this golden age of children's literature that I just described. Look what technology has done to give us access to art. Consider this. In the 15th century, when the great Florentine artist Cimabue completed his Madonna, the shops were closed. Workmen dropped their tools. Farmers left their tasks. The soldiers were released from the camp. All the people assembled in the streets. The artist was borne on the shoulders of the multitude. The picture was lifted up. The picture was lifted up and carried at the head of a procession that marched with music and banners and tumultuous shouts toward the church, where the canvas was hung that all people might feast their eyes upon its loveliness. One painting. Today, I can do a Google image search and pull up hundreds and thousands of masterpieces of art that I can be fed on. Masterpieces that have been buried in palaces and museums and private estates, I can pull up on my internet immediately. And why does it matter? Over 100 years ago, John Van Dyke wrote, "It will take years before you come to a full appreciation of art, but when at last you have it, you will be possessed of one of the purest, loftiest, and most ennobling pleasures that the civilized world can offer you." And look what technology has given us for music. Do you know YouTube's only been around since 2005? I can pull up just about any great masterpiece of music and watch it performed by the finest musicians around the world. I get a front row seat to the Bolshoi Ballet or the Metropolitan Opera for free. When I get ready to do my dishes, I can invite Leonard Bernstein into my kitchen with his entire symphony orchestra and hand him a playlist and be immersed in surround sound without any charge. It's pretty amazing. Brigham Young taught, "Sweet, harmonious sounds give exquisite joy to human beings capable of appreciating music. The master musicians made it possible for us to feel emotions that we never felt before, even revealing the very glory of God to the human heart. Music travels to a place in our hearts words alone cannot reach. The kings and queens of yesterday, with all their wealth, could not have had the kind of heart education that has just been delivered to your home for free. This is an education fit for a royal generation." My work of the last 10 years has been to gather, to search for and gather and collect these wonderful heart resources, which is what you'll find at Libraries of Hope, to make it a convenient starting place for your family to be able to access these. But there's just one missing piece for this great burst of light to happen. And for that missing piece, I need to go back to the golden age of ancient Greece. Scholars attribute the opening of that age to a poet named Pindar, who awakened a desire for beauty in the hearts of the Greeks through his poetry. But I asked myself, who awakened that desire in Pindar? And I found it in an old children's book. Pindar's teacher as a youth were two women, two renowned singers named Clirtis and Myrna, who sang songs into his heart. What we need now is a generation of mothers who can sing songs into the hearts of their children and awaken their desire to feast on this great harvest of riches that has just been delivered to them. But who will put the song in your heart? I believe the pattern was given by the resurrected Lord as he called for bread and wine to be brought. And he went to his chosen 12 disciples and he said, "Eat, and after you are filled, then feed the multitude." I believe that's the pattern for you. I believe you are the first generation of mothers to arrive on the scene when all things have been prepared for this very moment. I believe you've been prepared for this job. And as you begin to eat and be filled, it will be out of the treasures of your own heart that you will begin to sing the songs into the hearts of your children. As David O. McKay taught, only the warm heart can kindle warmth in another. Our hearts have been so depleted, it might take a little while to replenish, but we can begin. I believe that the heavens are watching, and angels are standing by to assist you. As Helen Hunt Jackson exclaimed over 100 years ago, "Oh, if the world could stop long enough for just one generation of mothers to be all right, what a millennium could be begun in just 30 years. I see mothers picking up where the mothers left off 100 years ago. I think we needed this reign of the Snow Queen because we needed technology to develop to gift us with what we have now. It was necessary. It's part of the combination, but it's time now to balance it out with the heart. And mothers are beginning to do what mothers do. They're organizing. I am watching mothers organize study groups, and they're beginning to study these writings of these wonderful heart educators 100 years ago. If you go to welleducatedheart.com, there's a mother's university where I've started to compile these writings for you to study. They're starting to do cultural things together. They're going to ballets and symphonies. There are wonderful courses in art and music appreciation aimed for the heart that are at Libraries of Hope from this golden age of literature. Mothers are relearning the art of storytelling in their home. They're using fine literature for book clubs instead of maybe a little more twaddle. They're learning the stories of history and nature. And that Delphinian course that I mentioned earlier, the bachelor's equivalent delivered to the moms, it's online for you for free, that you can do that. There's so many possibilities to support and encourage each other as you begin to fill your hearts. This journey is meant to be your own. It can be adapted to your circumstances and your capacity and your desires. But look what else technology has gifted you. My mother grew up on a potato farm in Idaho Falls, and she said that when she was a little girl, that her mother not only had eight little mouths to feed, she had to feed the farm hands. But she couldn't run down to the store. She'd go out to the creek and fish the suckers and cook them up, and then she would chop the wood and build a fire and go back to the creek, haul the water, fill a kettle, heat it up, do the dishes, and do it all over again. You put your dishes in a dishwasher and push a button and walk away. You put your clothes in a washing machine, you push a button and you walk away. You put food in the microwave, 5 minutes later it's hot, it's on the table. You turn the faucet and hot water comes out instantly. Technology has gifted you with time that no other generation of mothers has ever had for you to do this work. And one more gift of technology that this generation of mothers has that the ones didn't have 100 years ago. You have the ability and the gift to network. That means, how fast could a message of educating hearts of children spread? As you tell your friends who live in another place, who tell their friends, who tell their families. In fact, last week I did a conference, I hosted a conference, and I had some wonderful artists come and speak, and it was recorded. It's called The Simple Joy, and it's going to be posted on the website as soon as our videographer gets it on. Use this as a means to invite your friends in and to say, here's a message. What can we do to start feeding our hearts and the hearts of our children? It's for all mothers and for grandmothers, women of all ages. I see a network of mothers quietly weaving a net of safety and refuge, unknown to the world at large. As I keep saying, we are living in a great day of harvest, And we all know that harvests of fall are followed by winter. Farmers and God understands the necessity of winter. Many plants and people have to have the cold before they'll bloom. Winter is a time when growth is temporarily halted, while energy is held in reserve, building up for new growth. It's a time for growing stronger root systems. Without a sufficient chilling time, a fruit tree will generate fewer and weaker buds, and some seeds will just rot. The cold also destroys harmful bacteria and pests. Winter has been prophesied. But even in this winter, are seen a people making their way singing songs of joy. They carry their kingdom of light within. They have lit the beacon of light within, which is the theme of your conference. I don't worry about numbers. I know what a little leaven can do, a little salt, even one candle in a dark room. And remember, there was just one Pindar. In the final scene of Camelot, King Arthur reminds us what we all are, less than a drop in the great blue motion of the sunlit sea. But it seems that some of the drops sparkle. Some of them do sparkle. As you use the arts to stir feelings and awaken a desire for good, the beautiful and the true in the hearts of your children, and teach them the joy of complying with and obeying true principles, their kingdom of light within will grow. They will sparkle. And out of the treasures of their hearts, they will begin to build a new kingdom here upon the earth. 2 Corinthians reminds us, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And I would add, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is peace. There is love. Where there is light, there is joy. It's that simple. Thank you. The end.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.